There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Coming up, we see how data is being used by companies to sell products to us, how emotions play a role in online spending, and at what age would you let your children go to concerts by themselves? But first, Maurice Gravier, Chief Investment Officer of Emirates NBD, spoke about their investment outlook for 2019, where the forecast is not particularly optimistic.
Doing a yearly outlook is a very classical exercise that all banks do all the time, and which is absolutely logical. This year for us was particular because, we don't see 2018 as being just another year. We really saw last year as being a transition to a new and more perilous decade for investors. And, wealth management is about the long term. So we wanted to be very clear on the fact that we are starting a new decade with probably lower expected returns because of less growth, because of more debt, and still elevated risk. So our key view, our key point is really to get prepared for this new decade as regards investment process, portfolio construction, selectivity.
Okay, that sounds fairly gloomy. Lower expected returns, higher risk. So what do we do? Do we just stick our cash under the mattress for the next decade and come back in 2029 and then start investing? Or could we do something a bit more sophisticated with our money?
Well, first, putting your money under your mattress is very dangerous because the magic of investment, it's all about compounding returns over the long term. And being out of the markets means that you think you are able to time the market. And frankly, it's the second truth after the first being a difficult decade. Timing the market is very difficult. Now, there are probably three key things to navigate successfully the next decade. We've taken the analogy of a journey because at the end of the day, investing money is about transporting capital over time. We have a desert to cross. In this part of the world, we know that it's about skills preparation. So there are three things you should care about. The first is the robust portfolio construction, well diversified with capital preservation in mind. The time is for capital preservation now. The second, if you have volatility, if you are a long-term investor, it's a positive, actually. It creates opportunity. Markets will undershoot fundamentals. So if you have an idea of the fundamental fair value of an asset, volatility is an advantage. And the third point, and this is probably the most contrarian, is selectivity. We think the time of passive investing is behind us.
Okay, that's interesting because we've spoken a lot about passive investing here. It's low fee, which makes it appealing to investors like me. And it's done really, really well over the past two decades or so. Warren Buffett says we should just put our money in a passive S&P 500 tracker fund and go away. Why is that no longer a good idea?
Well, the last year, we've seen the end of many things. There have been concerns that are true questions. Is it the end of the cycle of quantitative easing, of globalization as we know it, of politics as we know it? And in the same logic, we think that passive investing has seen some limits. All passive investments are not bad. I'm not at all saying that. And ETFs are very useful. They are like Uber for taxi, more convenient, cheaper, they do the job. The point is that if all the market is in passive investing, it means that the key criteria is market cap. You have, for example, emerging markets, 40% of the economy, 12-13% of global equity index. For us, it is an anomaly. For fixed income, market cap is more or less the size of your debt. So in a global government bond index, you have Japan, 28%. You have Germany, 5%. I mentioned these two because they have negative yields. So you shouldn't go passive everywhere. And this is for the risk side. When things go wrong, people sell what they own, and what they own is indices. When things go right, you have less growth. So the best business model makes a difference.
I can understand from an institutional perspective that you'd want to maybe have a sort of active investment portfolio. But from an individual side, for people who have got a bit of wealth, particularly for people who say looking to retire and who might give their money to a money manager, but that money manager will charge them a lot of money for going in and out of different funds and lots of commissions and things. And yet, because they're a small player, won't be giving them the attention and certainly not anything like full-time attention. They could well get left out. You're paying high fees and you're not a top priority. That sounds like a recipe for disaster to me.
That's interesting. You know, investment managers, they have to earn their fees, which means that at the end, you have to deliver a better net return than the index. That's the key. If you don't, you should be out of the market. And that's exactly what happened in the last 10 years. You know, there have been natural selections among active fund managers, among hedge funds, among many people. And the part of fees in the total return of a client is important, and especially when we see low returns looking forward. So you have to earn your fees, and that's why it's really about, I'm not saying that you should go from something cheap to something expensive with the same outcome. I'm saying that really selection should deliver more results looking forward. There are cycles in everything in finance. You know, I think mean reversion is really the dominating force behind market, like it or not. And that's why the next decade could be a bit difficult, by the way. But it also means that if all the markets own the very same companies and sell the same at the same time, we have an issue. Same for debt. With the amount of debt that you have in the system, you have to be very selective about the issuers. And at the end, it would create better performance, even after the fees that would have been earned legitimately, by a manager.
Very quickly, Maurice, before we let you go, a couple of recommendations, thing we should be buying. You say one of your tips is emerging market stocks and also gold. Let's begin with gold. Why gold?
Yeah, absolutely. Gold has many virtues. Actually, for return, we like emerging market assets in general, and I'll come back to that in a second. For risk mitigations, we like cash and gold. More cash than government bonds because it has more or less the same yield and flexibility. And as regards gold, it is one of the rare assets who brings true diversification. And we see there is price upside. It's not just about having a bunker if things go wrong. We think that gold should be worth $1,400 at the end of the year.
Maurice, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much indeed. So many ideas to talk about. Come back and we'll knock those about in a bit more detail. But for now, Maurice Gravier is the Chief Investment Officer at Emirates NBD, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Now we look at how data is being used by companies to sell products to us with Byron Gavin, Head of Data and Analytics at RBBI. He began by explaining what they do.
As an agency, generally what we do is go into our clients, say, for an example, it could be a retail client or an e-commerce client, and understand what their challenges are, what the problems are, and what they're trying to solve. So we might look at what customers are the most valuable and who they should be talking to. Like you said, from a footprint that they have, you know, we can go out and reach customers that are most likely to convert. But also we look at, say, the website performance and try and figure out why people or consumers are breaking out of the funnel and they're not actually converting on the website. So it's all about finding the right customers and making sure that the user journey and the user experience on their website is efficiently built.
Typically, would that be things like, I mean, I come to you, I'm a retailer with a website that's okay, but not brilliant. I want to double my online sales and ask you, what can you do for me? Mm. Or is it the likes of, for instance, Sears, which is the sort of massive American department store chain that's sort of slowly going bust? If I did come to you and said I want to double my online sales, what would you actually say?
Yeah, so I suppose I'd first understand what users are turning up to the site.
Yeah.
You know, what is the traffic that they do have? How do we get them to convert at a higher rate? So we also, that's where the data comes heavily in there, where we go into their, say, marketing Google Analytics platform, and we'll sort of make funnels and understand how people are going through the journey.
So when you say convert, you mean make a sale?
Make a sale, yes.
So what sort of, if you like, footprints do I leave behind?
Yeah.
I go on to search for a flight to somewhere. Mm. What can you take out of that interaction with the internet?
Yeah, so quite a lot, but in a positive way. You know, when you land on a website, we know not your name. We don't know anything personally identifiable about you, but we will know, say, a unique number that is your cookie ID, which is this footprint, and the pages that you looked at, what you clicked on, everything that you kind of did on the website. And even if you didn't make that conversion or make that sale, we then sort of look at why you didn't, and maybe we figured out that you weren't ready to purchase yet. So that's when we might...
How would you figure out my intentions? How do you actually know that much about
me? Yeah, sure. So there's segments or groups of people that, that act in the same way on websites. So we can start by looking at people that do convert and what were the signals before they converted. That gives us that answer. So when people might turn up, they might turn up to the same website 3 to 4 times, and there's a likeliness of them to convert because they've done the research, they've understood what they want, and then they've gone through the checkout funnel and they've made the purchase.
Mentioning that sort of I've come back to a particular website 4 times, does the algorithm then sort of know that I am actually quite serious about purchasing something, and does it put the price up accordingly? Have I triggered a price rise by going in 4 times?
No. So the price won't move from the fact that you've come back 4 times. There is regulations around that price and doing that. You know, it's more the opposite, to be 100% honest. So what we want to do is ultimately convert the user, as we've discussed. So it's most of the time, if you come back, you might see more specials or promotions that might be, 10% off, 20% off to try and push you down, to make that conversion. So it's not that the price will move higher, it's that promotions will happen. And that's why you do see some promotions across the internet to try and get you to make that decision.
That's what I was just about to say, Byron. If I go and look at flights, for example, I'm browsing on my laptop and I look at a flight to, let's say, Australia, where you're from, and then I go away, don't make the sale, but I'm perhaps then doing something else online, I am likely to see that flight advertised down the side of what I'm reading. Now, are you finding that people then do come back because they're prompted by this, or is that kind of marketing changing now?
They do come back because they're prompted by it. We know there's so much competition in the market for these things, so trying to reach that user again across the internet is a valuable way of enticing them to return. But we discover that it's not. It's a combination of things. So when you see those ads across the internet on other websites, that's one thing. You might see paid media ads. There's also offline marketing that might help. So it's a combination of the right things that the user needs to see to convert. But that's definitely a very valuable way to entice users to come back to the website.
Has the European GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, changed how and what personal data you can or do collect here in the Middle East?
It's certainly made people look at it in a more intense way. What the GDPR has done is bring regulations around and that protects the consumer. That's why when you go on a website, you might see that the pop-up that says
tick or accept.
Can I accept this? So that's definitely something that's more. We're seeing more of it in this region. It's mandatory in the EU, but I think that a lot of the companies and a lot of the markets are actually following. It may be the EU, but a lot of the other markets are just conforming to those types of regulations because I think that the rest of the markets will pick this up.
And finally, Byron, of course, you work for these companies. The end game here is to get us as customers to buy more. What tips do you have for us as consumers then? Because if we know this information is being used, what's a smart way for us to shop?
Yeah, sure. So, if users have the decision, if they don't want to be tracked and followed, then they can go into their Google Chrome account and block the cookies and block the footprint from happening. But as a consumer, I tend to look at it as it's a convenience factor. We want the items that we put in our cart or checkout to be there when we return if we didn't want to, purchase at that time.
So you mentioned that you can improve the way companies with an online presence actually perform and the return they get from the hits they have from people like myself and Natalie.
Yeah.
What about that other example I threw at you, Sears, who don't have a particularly great online presence despite starting out life as a mail order company? If I came to you and said, look, I really haven't got an online presence, can you do that as well?
Yes. So that's an acquisition thing. There's a lot of people searching around online. There's a lot of people on different websites. So we would then look at, say, this is from our media side of things, our paid media, where we would look at an acquisition strategy to try and get more consumers to come to that website so that we can make them aware, make them turn up, and then hopefully build them into loyal customers.
Byron Gavin, Head of Data and Analytics at RBBI. Thank you. We look forward to welcoming you back.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Brooke Cowling is the co-founder and CMO of Digital of Things. Brooke explained how tracking people's emotions while using the internet helps online spending habits form.
What we do is we use technology to track people's emotions and their facial expressions so we can understand how they feel when they're actually engaging with a brand online. So, I mean, there's a number of things that we do in the lab. What we do is we bring in real customers. So we want to conduct one-to-one interviews with users. And generally these tests last for 1 hour. So we would do a moderated session with real customers and why they're using a website, an app, even a television live streaming service. And we capture their facial expressions, so we can tell if they're angry, they're sad, they're confused when they're engaging with the brand. And we also track their eye gaze, so we can see what they're looking at on screen. And in addition to this, we talk to the customers, so we understand why. We really want to understand why they do things online, not just observing their behavior. So it's really quite interesting because you're going to get a lot of data and information from customers just by seeing how they respond to an experience online.
So we have this on the Dubai Eye Facebook live stream because, like you say, it's important to look at what people are thinking, feeling. So you're under the spotlight now, of course. We're doing this live, so we can see your immediate reaction. And I guess that's what you do in the lab. But how does this then help the companies that perhaps want to come and work with you? If I'm thinking, I own a business, I want to sell lots and lots more swimwear. How can I use this emotional intelligence and this technology to improve my sales?
Sure. I think that we're living in a really exciting time and, you know, customer experience is used a lot at the moment. And it's not something that has been used in this region and it's coming more and more to the forefront. You know, there are constant advancements in technology and we are in an emerging market. So customer experience is not as advanced in this region compared to other markets, say the UK or Australia. And it's very easy to switch to the competition. So even coming here, I've got my Uber and my Careem app, you know, next to each other on my phone. Do I use Uber if I can get a different level of experience from Careem? And when customers engage our services, they want to understand what the pain points are from their customers. So when we bring in users to test their websites and their apps, what we're really doing is understanding what their pain points are and we're addressing those pain points and we're telling our customers how they can fix that and how they can make their experience better for their users, which in turn increases revenue, it increases conversion and also brand loyalty.
And if you are using the internet to shop, for example, not just using a transport system, if I'm thinking I want to go and buy something, how do you encourage them through your research to improve the websites? I mean, what is the concept? You take someone into a lab like me and you sit me down, you see my reaction to three or four different kinds of things, or is it more complex than that? Do you want to know, am I frustrated with how long it takes me to get to the basket? Do I have to sign in and make an account? Is it important that my card details are registered?
Yeah, there's a number of factors. And what we do is we work very closely with our clients to understand what their pain points and their objectives are. And then we set out a test plan. So we set tasks that we actually walk through with the customers. And as we do the moderator test, this is when we're recording their emotions and their eye gaze. And we ask them specific questions to see what their frustrations are. So if it's a page load time, that could be a frustration. If it's not being able to check out quickly or they've forgotten their password and they need to reset a password, is that experience good for the user? Is it something that the client needs to fix? And what recommendations can we give them to improve that customer experience?
Give me an example.
Okay, so we work with quite a lot of international clients, for example. So this concept is relatively new in this region. We have worked with a food delivery app, which is headquartered in the UK. And one of the advantages of that is that, you know, we have access to a global audience here. So one of the pain points for, let's say, our clients is that they want to test with multiple demographics and they want to get a broad range of customers to test with. And the UAE is a melting pot. You know, we have over 200 nationalities here. So we have access to these customers and we can bring them in and we can test.
And they want to figure out how we react when using their website. Does it work with mobile devices as well?
It does. So we have a mobile stand device. We test with website. We can also do in-store. So we actually do retail experiences and we have portable glasses where we can track people's eye gaze as they move through a retail environment. We can look at wayfinding signage. We can look at where they're looking on the shelves. We can actually see if they're looking at certain products compared to their competition. So it's really quite advanced technology that we're using.
And are people's responses on a sliding scale? I'm just sort of imagining, you know, you think of pilot season in America and they have an audience watching a TV show and they get good dials or bad dials. So a good dial would be if they thought something was funny or liked a character, they turn the dial up. If they don't like a character or a plot, they turn the dial down. So are you monitoring things on a sliding scale or is it just sort of an option they like or dislike?
No, when we're tracking their facial expressions, there's 500 points in the face that we actually pinpoint and we map. And we have overall scales where we're talking about happy, sad, confused, angry. And then we can actually get a bit more granular and we can see certain points in the face if they've raised their eyebrow or they've slightly raised their lip to see what that emotion is. And the software, it's really great software that's come out of Europe. It's 93% accurate and it's a lot more accurate than if you were studying human behaviour, human to human.
I'm just, Richard will not mind me saying this in public at all, but I don't know how well it works on people if they've perhaps had treatments to their face and are unable to mimic those impressions. So I don't know how successful that might be on everyone in this room, but we might have to get him down to the lab to find out.
I think that would be a great idea. I think that if you want to come down to the lab, we can definitely put you through the motions and show you how it works, show you how the technology works.
No needles.
Okay. No needles.
Well, Brooke, thank you very much for joining us. Brooke Cowling is the co-founder and CMO of Digital of Things. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai i 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. What age would you let your children go to a concert unattended? It's as we look forward to Redfest DXB. Lots of big artists coming to Dubai this weekend. And we asked you how old you were when you went to your first concert and what age you think children should be when they go alone. All of that was involved on our Dubai Eye Twitter poll and lots of you got in touch. Mark said, my 16 and 13-year-old daughters are both going to Redfest with separate groups of friends. So I think it's interesting we're talking about how old people are when they go. And we've been asking for your views. Here's one of them.
I went to my first concert at about the age of 14 with my parents and sisters, and it was the Junoon concert, the Pakistani rock band. Yeah, that's what I remember of it. And I think it was in the Al Nasser Leisureland.
So Pakistani rock group wasn't something I was familiar with, but Mark, I'm kind of on the same theme as you. Now, you've been telling me about Chicken Shack.
Chicken Shack was a group in the late 60s. And I would say to you that, you know, although you've never heard of it and you think it's ridiculous, sort of progressive rock from the 60s, there was a link because the lead singer at the time was Christine Perfect. She went on to marry John McVie and join Fleetwood Mac, but she had a single in the early 70s, which is just made her name as an independent artist. This is it.
Now I know that.
You know the song, do you?
Yeah.
I mean, it was a big hit. I don't know where it got into the charts, certainly, but maybe two or three in the charts. But it was a good song, and she sang it well. Great voice. You get a demonstration of the voice there.
Wasn't what I was expecting from Chicken Shack, though,
Chicken
at all.
Chicken Shack is nothing like that, I'm afraid.
Now,
Chicken Shack is much, much, much heavier.
Richard, from memory, his first concert was at the Apollo in Manchester. That's correct.
The first one I went to on my own.
On your own.
Without my parents.
Okay.
1986, so I would have been 14 years old. It was late March, early April, because it was just before my school Easter ski trip. I can remember it very, very well. It was a big moment in my life. They were a big band at the time, and it was Tapao.
It's a great song.
For the benefit of everyone listening, there's swaying and arms waving in the studio. Nice one, Rich.
Anthemic.
1986. You said there that your parents took you, it was the first time you went to without your parents. Had your parents taken you to concerts previously?
I'd been with my sister before, who was 6 years older than me, which is adult supervision. But
I bet she enjoyed that, dragging a little brother along.
She got to go for free, so I think it was swings and roundabouts.
One of those ones. So my first one was with my cousin, and it was one of those dropped off at the front door, picked up on the way back. And it was a boy band, big, big boy band in the 90s, but not Take That.
To go away. Don't think I could take the pain. Won't you stay another day?
I remember the video clearly for this song as well. They were in white coats with fur around the hood and it was snowing.
It was a Christmas song, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And for my money, up there with George Michael's Last Christmas as a classic.
Classic.
Christmas pop song.
Festive classic. So those were our first concerts. I was probably about the same age as you, Rich, about 14. And we were allowed to go, my cousin and I. And I was a sensible one, so I don't know. My cousin must have been crazy.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
That's it from Business Breakfast Nightcap. We're back on air tomorrow at 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.